I get what you mean.
I still see this place as it was in the 40s. Terence looked about, and she did as well, trying to picture what he described. Gleaming and beautiful. A masterpiece. The red carpet rolled out for the 20th Century Limited to Chicago, right there on Track 34.
She smiled as if she hadn't heard the same thing a week earlier from Dennis. Boys and their trains.
You see up there? He pointed to the blackened ceiling. That used to be a vivid turquoise color.
Virginia laughed. He was teasing her. No way. I don't believe that one bit. But he didn't crack a smile. In any event, it's like a cave now. Dark and scary. I don't think many other people see it the way you do.
I suppose so.
His face took on a sad cast. An irate man in a black top hat banged on the window. Terence sighed, removed the window closed placard, and patiently explained that the man's mastiff would not be allowed on the train to Greenwich under any circumstances. After work, as Virginia waited for the elevator to the Penn Central offices, the metal grillwork above the doors caught her eyes. Like the filigree, the design was complicated and showy. A slew of wrought iron vines twisted around the floor indicator, and recessed in the marble trim immediately above was a leaf and acorn wreath in bronze. The terminal was like a giant gallery of hidden art. You just had to know where to look. What was that expression from her art major days? Memento mori, where an object in the artwork served as a warning of death. Usually it was a skull or an hourglass, a bowl of rotting fruit. Grand Central, in its decaying splendor, was the embodiment of a memento mori work of art. If it came down, Terence's heart would be broken. Virginia put on fresh lipstick as the car rose. She asked the receptionist to announce her to Dennis and planted herself in the same chair she'd waited in a week ago. Dennis shambled out, looking tired. But when he saw her, he put his hands on his hips and laughed.
Look at that haircut. I love it. Very French.
Thanks.
Come right this way. I don't have much time, but I think you'll be impressed.
He put his hand on the small of her back to guide her, leaving it there a little longer than necessary, and she felt a zing of desire. On a table inside his office, a large white model rose up 3 feet. Dennis's description of the proposed skyscraper was apt. The building literally sat on top of the front half of the station, with long supports like spider legs jutting out onto the transverse. It was rectangular, windowed, and boring.
What do you think? Dennis asked.
She thought for a moment. It's very modern.
You bet. Think of all the rent money that will pour in, as well as the taxes for the city. It's good for everyone.
Where will your office be? She teased.
Right there.
Dennis pointed to the top floor. He leaned in and gave her a quick kiss before his phone rang.
Give me a sec.
While he spoke, she studied the model further. Grand Central would become even darker, with the new building blocking most of the windows. Terence and Winston and the others would be stuck below ground, like mole people.
Dennis hung up the phone. I'm sorry. I have a meeting I have to get to.
Of course. She wanted to ask more questions about the new building, find out how exactly it would affect the railroad terminal, but before she could speak, Dennis kissed her, long and slow. When they drew apart, she was glad for his arms around her, or she might have wobbled to the floor. She really shouldn't have waited as long as she did to get out in the world after her divorce. With men like Dennis around, smart and just the right amount of burly, a woman could get everything that she didn't get in a marriage. Compliments, sex,
and downtime when she could just be herself. Of course, he still didn't know her secret. But for the first time, she could imagine telling him about the cancer, about her missing piece. As she walked down the hall, knowing he was watching her, she added a little kick to her step, a sway to her hips. It was nice being wanted. Instead of going back down by elevator, Virginia headed to the art school, clutching the can of mace Dennis had given her last week, just in case any hoodlums might be lurking about. She tucked it back inside her purse as she wandered through the rooms, keeping an eye out for anything that might help identify the artist behind the watercolor. The lockers contained ancient paints, brushes with hardened bristles, and other detritus of no value. The narrow wooden slots for storing large canvases were mostly empty, and the few artworks that remained had faded, paint chips forming a mosaic beneath them. How sad for this place to be lost to time, with no one left to mourn it. The same could be said for the entire terminal, if Dennis got his way. She combed through the desks in the small offices, but discovered nothing other than a fountain pen, a jar of dried black ink, and a couple of pencils. She wasn't sure what she was looking for, but in any case, nothing jumped out as important. At the entrance to the storage room, though, she froze. Two new crates had been opened and pulled into the center of the room. The wall of artwork had changed again. Two bright monochromes in orange, which definitely hadn't been there before, were tacked up in the very center. Someone had been in here, digging through the crates, putting paintings up and taking them down, looking for something. This was no ghost. A muffled moan sounded from another room. She froze, hoping to hear Dennis's baritone calling out her name. Had she locked the door behind her? She couldn't remember. Those thugs, the ones she'd encountered last week, might be back. If she screamed, who would hear her? No one. She was trapped. She unzipped her purse to retrieve the can of mace, the sound louder than expected, and heard footsteps in response. A shuffling, followed by a loud bang. Now there was no doubt in her mind. Someone else was inside the school. Virginia ran through her options. Whoever else was inside was somewhere between her and the front door. She looked about for a place to hide, a closet or under a desk, but the thought of staying put terrified her. Running as if she was on fire, Virginia made it to the exit without looking right or left, staring straight ahead at her goal, sure that at any moment an arm would reach out and grab her hair, her clothes, and yank her backward. She fumbled with the doorknob, breathing heavily, her hands shaking, and finally turned it. Bursting into the hallway, she headed right, to safety. A man in a suit stood in front of the elevator. Thank God. Not Dennis, but not a thug. She looked behind her for the first time since her sprint. No one was there. No one was coming.
Are you all right?
The man's eyes showed a wary concern. She could only imagine what she looked like, rumpled, her face red, eyes wide.
I'm fine. Thank you.
The elevator opened.
After you?
She rushed inside, breathing hard, relief setting in, only after the doors had closed. Chapter 11, May 1929.
They'll be here any moment, Clara. Do hurry.
Clara nodded at Oliver through the reflection of her vanity mirror. He looked as handsome as ever in a natty yellow bow tie and two-toned Oxfords, his face flushed with excitement at the arrival of their dinner party guests and from the martini he'd drunk while dressing.
He drew close and kissed her on the top of her head.
Sorry. I know you must be tired. You've been working all day, and now I'm forcing you to hobnob with strangers. You aren't mad, are you?
Of course not, my love. I know how you enjoy your salons. She tilted her face up, and he kissed her properly, slowly, until she was dizzy and breathless. It still amazed her that this beautiful boy was all hers. So much had happened since she'd signed the contract with Vogue last year. At times, Clara's new apartment at 25 Fifth Avenue was unrecognizable, the squeaky cot from her 10th Street studio replaced with a macassar bed fit for a queen with an inlaid parchment headboard. Oliver had laid eyes on it in some uptown furniture store and insisted she take it. They weren't exactly living together. He still had his bachelor pad in the village, but he spent most of the day and many of the evenings here, answering her correspondence, arranging social events like tonight's dinner, and generally making her life run as smoothly as possible.
What were you working on today?
He sat at the edge of the bed and adjusted a cufflink. They want a dozen new illustrations for a piece on the well-dressed secretary, and of course the September cover. All day she'd been working on the cover. A woman at the wheel of an automobile facing out, the door open, one hand casually resting on the steering wheel and the other on the back of the seat. The figure had come easy enough, but she'd been struggling over the details of the car when Oliver had told her it was time to wash up and dress. Like an obedient child, she'd cleaned off her brushes and palette and closed the door of her studio behind her. She'd never have attained the success she had without him. Between the commissions and teaching, she was even able to sock money away. The school term would end in a few weeks, and she was thrilled to have had a class of 30 this term with no dropouts at all. She slid a pair of crystal combs into her unruly mane. I forgot to mention, Mr. Lorette at the art school said my class would be moved to a bigger studio in the fall, to fit the additional students.
Isn't that tiring, though? Why teach when you don't have to?
The smile on his face belied his concern, she knew. Lately, he'd complained they didn't spend enough time together, suggesting a long weekend at Campo Beach or a jaunt to Europe. But now that she finally had the work she had craved for so long, she couldn't bear to walk away. She also had a terrible fear that it was all going to be taken away at any moment. That was what had happened to her father, after all. One day they were eating steaks and caramel custard, the next she was scrounging in a vegetable garden for potatoes to make soup. She understood that rationally it was her father's own fault, but that sense of fragility, of everything all coming crashing down, stayed with her always. She was like one of those squirrels in Washington Square Park, tucking nuts in their cheeks and burying the rest of the bounty. The taste of success had only increased her urge to accumulate more. More work, more money. And it had all come so quickly. The months flew by in a blur, yet every morning when she rose, she peered out her bedroom window, the rectangular buildings and conical water towers sharp against a blue sky, and gave a moment of thanks for Oliver, for her work, and for this lovely city. She didn't mention the other reason she enjoyed going to the School of Art twice a week. Sometimes, after class, she and Levon would meet for a coffee in the Grand Central Terminal restaurant. Or they'd sneak off for a quick smoke away from the students, in her favorite place in the building, a secret room behind the huge Tiffany clock that overlooked 42nd Street. While there was no reason to keep this from Oliver, after all, she had friendships with many male artists these days, Oliver and Levon never seemed to get on. They'd run into each other at a couple of faculty dinners at the Lorette's brownstone in the village, where Levon had drunk too much and carried on about the superiority of Armenian poets over American ones. Clara didn't blame Oliver, really. While she admired the depth of Levon's knowledge and his natural exuberance, He could become a tedious conversationalist when his authority was questioned. Clara often teased him that he'd win even more admirers than he had already amassed if he could only pretend, on occasion, that he thought slightly less of himself. But Levon was even more defensive and self-aggrandizing now than he had been when they first met. He'd been stuck in an artistic rut for some time, painting the mother and child over and over, unable to move forward. Clara's good fortune made her want to assist in some way. She'd insisted he be invited to that night's dinner party, even though the thought made her nervous. The guest list was eclectic, a mix of poets and singers, as well as a couple of moneyed husbands and lovers. If Levon was in a charming mood, he might be able to entice a potential buyer to a studio visit. She patted some rouge on her cheeks and smiled. Oliver enjoyed pulling together people from different walks of life. He was a natural as a host, even though sometimes she wondered if his energies might be better put into his poetry. "I do appreciate you bringing the mountain to Mohammed. To have a dinner party in my own home without having to lift a finger? You've been a dream. Who are we expecting tonight?" The doorbell rang and Oliver leaped to his feet. "A banker and his ode-writing poet mistress, an automobile executive and his opera-singing wife, a fellow alum from Andover, and, of course, Levon." The last name hung in the air. "I'll make the introductions. You won't have to worry about a thing." He disappeared, off to help her maid greet the guests. They were eight around the dining room table, a shiny walnut number with a matching sidebar, where a silver-plated cocktail set and tray sparkled in the candlelight. Another of Oliver's finds. Levon strode in late, catching Oliver up in an awkward hug and kissing Clara's hand before diving into a conversation about European politics with the Andover classmate. Seated to Clara's left was Mr. Cavanaugh, the banker, a man with a penchant for expensive clothes and inexpensive dentistry, judging from his yellowed teeth. He gushed over Clara, remarked on her latest cover, asked her about the Paris fashions.
"My wife goes over every season, you know. She adores your work. Has even had several framed for our house in Glen Cove."
She smiled and answered his rapid-fire questions with as much grace as she could muster. After all, how lovely it was to be sought after instead of desperately seeking. "Framed. I'm touched. How kind of her."
"Yes, like they're real art."
Real art. As if her imagination, technique, and execution were false. "What are you working on now, Miss Darden?"
The banker's mistress, a slight red-headed woman named Sally, chirped from the other end of the table.
"Another cover, and another one after that." Each had to be better than the last, more whimsical. Illustrators were glorified factory workers, she'd complained to Levon just that week. There was always someone new coming up the ranks, offering a unique angle, just as she had. Oliver piped up.
"Clara's contracted through the end of this year with Vogue, and I have no doubt they'll renew for another year."
The banker's mistress took several puffs from her cigarette holder, her eyes glittering.
"I loved the latest issue. The cover was gorgeous, of course, but there were also so many delightful photographs. One layout, do you call it a layout?"
She didn't wait for Clara's response.
"Showed the most divine tweed suits. I swear I could see every thread."
Mr. Cavanaugh held up his wine glass for the maid to refill.
"Do you think eventually magazines will be all photographs? What would all the illustrators do then?"
"It'll never happen."
Oliver looked over at Clara, silently apologizing for the turn in the conversation.
"Photography is far too expensive and not nearly as expressive."
Mr. Cavanaugh slapped the table.
"Good to hear. Speaking of expression, how is your poetry going, Mr. Smith?
You and Sally are in that literary group together, aren't you?
Oliver hadn't written anything new in months. Clara had told him he didn't have to do so much for her, that he ought to take time out for himself, but he'd brushed her off. Perhaps after dinner you both could read some of your work, she suggested. One of the other guests was going to sing. The Andover alum had brought a guitar. If she could persuade Oliver to share his work, get some approbation, he might be newly inspired. Sally squealed with delight, but Oliver shot Clara a worried look. I'm still in the early stages, I'm afraid. I've been so busy lately. She tried again.
Maybe one of your earlier poems?
She looked out over the table. He's an extraordinary talent.
Don't, Clara.
The other conversations at the table, including Levon's, quieted down as the tension rose. She hadn't meant to put him on the spot. Clara turned to the guest to her right, a gentleman who manufactured and sold Studebaker automobiles, to take the attention off Oliver. Mr. Bianchi was his name, and his wife was the singer in the group.
Tell me, Mr. Bianchi, what's your favorite poem?
The man chuckled and wiped his mouth with his napkin. He wore round spectacles that echoed his bulbous nose.
I do love the Italian decadence. D'Annunzio and the like.
Mr. Bianchi winked at her. Levon's fork clattered to the table.
The fascist. Sometimes you have to ignore the politics and focus on the poetry. Is it possible to ignore politics? I'm sorry. I've upset you.
Mr. Bianchi shrugged.
What can I say? I like beautiful things. Beautiful poetry, beautiful art, beautiful cars.
The maid began serving dessert, an upside-down cake, as Clara grappled to gain control of the conversation.
What's your latest automobile model?
Ah, that's quite exciting. It's a lower-priced one called the Dictator.
Dear God. Levon spoke with his mouth full of cake.
Really, you can't be serious.
Clara noticed Oliver wince at his bad manners. She should have never invited him. Levon finally swallowed.
You want to speak of dictators? In the last decade of the last century, Sultan Abdulhamid II of the Ottoman Empire concentrated power into his own hands and ordered the massacre of the Armenian people.
A startled Mr. Bianchi turned red.
We don't mean that kind of dictator. We're imagining someone like Mussolini, a man of strength, of power. Our lines include the commander, the president, and now the dictator. It dictates the standard.
Oliver stepped in.
Of course, that makes perfect sense. It's an uphill battle.
Mr. Bianchi shook his head.
The market is saturated. Everyone owns a car these days. Our hope is that a cheaper model will encourage families to buy two.
He waved a chubby hand at Clara. In fact, next week we're bringing in a consulting group of lady decorators to help us figure out the best way to appeal to the wives.
You should come on board. We could use an artist in the group.
Clara thought of her current cover. A close-up look at the latest car model might inspire her. Also, as much as she didn't want to admit it, the banker's mistress had a point about the threat of photography. Clara could envision a time in the future when magazine illustrators were reduced to scrambling for crumbs. Branching out into consulting work was a wise idea. But she didn't want to be lumped in with a group of lady decorators. She had more to offer Mr. Bianchi than that.
I'd be happy to get involved. In fact, I bet I can solve your problem.
How so?
It's all in the ad campaign. I bet I can create one that will make your dictator the best-selling car of the year.
As she spoke, her excitement grew. Mr. Bianchi sat back and studied her.
You could you? Of course she could. You're talking to Clara Darden, one of the finest instructors at the Grand Central School of Art.
Levon raised his glass to her, and Clara bowed her head slightly in response, hoping to temper his enthusiasm.
"Do you really have time to do car advertisements?"
Oliver again. "Your schedule is quite booked already." He was trying to save her, thinking she was being bulldozed. But he was wrong. She wanted this. Something new. Something that would provide some contrast to her magazine covers. "Plenty of other illustrators do designs for more than fashion magazines. I don't see why I can't as well." Sally giggled.
"But automobiles? It's not very feminine work."
Clara sat back, crossed her arms, and shot Sally a look that made her choke on her laughter. "Maybe it should be." A week after the dinner party, Clara was picked up by a gleaming Studebaker sent by Mr. Bianchi and driven to the factory where the cars were made, a massive drab cement structure about an hour away from the city. Mr. Bianchi's well-appointed office, however, was a pleasant surprise, replete with geometric paneling and Rollman chairs. Finely detailed toy cars dotted the bookshelves. Four other women, two of whom were renowned designers, sat in chairs in a semicircle around Mr. Bianchi's desk. Clara made her way to the empty seat as introductions were made.
"I'm so pleased you could join me today. Would anyone like a drink?"
Mr. Bianchi's nose twitched. All the women, save Clara, declined the offer. He poured a couple of scotches from a bar concealed behind one of the panels, then handed a glass to Clara. She drank a sip, careful to not let him see how it burned her throat.
"On my desk, you'll see the latest design for the dictator. Take a look and let me know your thoughts. We want to know what's the best way to market it so women will encourage their husbands to snap one up over all our competitors."
The ladies huddled around the desk as Mr. Bianchi made his way to the back of the room. Better to study their figures, Clara surmised. This was all a sham so he could announce to the world that he'd designed a car using the input of women. He really didn't want to hear what they said. The drink made her bolder than she might have been otherwise, more easily outraged. But she patiently waited her turn to study the drawings. Each page offered a different view. The exterior, the interior dash, details of the hardware.
"Who is your ideal buyer for this car?"
asked one of the other consultants.
"A family that requires a second so the wife can tootle around town while the husband's at work. Or a family that's just starting out, that can't afford our more expensive lines."
Clara spoke up. "What's the price point?"
"I see you've studied the terminology. Well done. Around $1,200.
The ladies spoke over one another in an effort to impress.
"You must have an advertisement of a man opening the door for the lady, and maybe she's dressed like Cinderella going to a ball. How about a woman behind the wheel with a little boy on her lap pretending to drive? That'll warm the hearts of the mothers."
While they brainstormed, Clara wandered over to an observation window to the right of the desk, which looked down at the factory floor. Below, hundreds of men attended to the assembly lines, lifting parts from trolleys and affixing them to metal chassis, an intimate dance of muscles and machinery. She touched her fingertips to the glass.
"I'd like to go down on the floor."
Mr. Bianchi blanched.
"You don't want to go down there. You'll get grubby. I'd hate to see you spoil your lovely dress."
She insisted, and he called in a foreman, who handed her a smock as they headed down several flights of stairs to the floor, where the noise level almost burst her eardrums and the smell of grease and sweat threatened to overwhelm her. Instead of covering her nose, she inhaled deeply. This is what car making was all about. They were machines, and the design was secondary to the utility. but that didn't mean the design was superfluous. The foreman, unlike Mr. Bianchi, didn't rush her. She got down on her hands and knees and peered under a finished car, curious what she would find. Another worker pointed out the various locks and hinges of the hefty doors, and she ran her fingers over the cold metal. As a fashion illustrator, she had learned to pay attention to material, color, line, and anatomy. An automobile, which was almost like a coat of armor, was no different from a coat of fur. Protection against the world. Back in Mr. Bianchi's office, the other ladies were long gone. He looked up in surprise.
Miss Darden, I'd forgotten about you entirely. What on earth have you been doing?
Clara pulled off the smock and pointed at the drawing. Not even the cleverest advertisement will work if the interior of the car isn't functional for women. Right now, it's not. There are too many knobs that stick out, gears that get in the way. It's too easy for her to catch a sleeve on a gear shift or a glove on an instrument gauge.
He regarded her warily.
We thought women might like all the styling. The rosettes, for instance, on the robe rail. Don't you think they're pretty?
There's too much frippery entirely. Women don't want to be riding in a stagecoach from the Georgian age. This is a new American mode of transport and ought to reflect that. Look at our clothing. No more bustles and corsets.
Mr. Bianchi blushed, but she kept on, picking up a fountain pen and drawing right on the plans.
You want only clean lines inside the vehicle, an Art Deco approach. Get rid of the boxiness of the dash and curve the edges. Everywhere.
Her pen raced across the paper, her hand sure and even.
The door handles could look like this. Tuck the ashtray away, here.
He studied them for a long moment, his brow furrowed.
Do you really think this will sell?
Let me go back to my studio and come up with some proper sketches for you. Let's make the 1930 Studebaker something that everyone will talk about.
I'm not sure. This is rather overwhelming.
If she were a man, no doubt he'd give her opinion more consideration. She stopped drawing and gestured for him to sit. He did so, blinking with uncertainty.
You can use me to sell it.
Use you?
All this past year, I've been telling women what looks good. What's a quality product, and why they should buy it through my illustrations. I can do the same for you. Hire me for the interior design of the Dictator, as well as the advertisement campaign. In the ads, we'll use my name, styled by Clara Darden. They'll trust my taste and insist their husbands buy your car.
He looked at the plans, avoiding her stare. He was balking.
Well, I'll have to see.
As a girl, she'd listened while her father bamboozled potential clients and had picked up some of his techniques. Time to close the deal.
Here's what you do. Go home and ask your wife. Tell her about our conversation. Then call me tomorrow and we'll talk numbers.
A strong handshake, and she was out the door. That evening, Clara shared the day's events with Oliver as they lay in bed. His face stayed still, inscrutable.
Is this why you came to New York City? To design car door handles?
It's not just the handle, it's the entire interior, possibly the exterior as well. I'm shaping the car, you see? Like a sculpture.
If you want to do sculpture, then do that. Don't pretend that prettying up an automobile is art, though.
His words hurt, but he didn't understand. She tried again.
I'm not prettying it up. Machines can be beautiful, just like furniture, which can be pleasing to the eye and functional at the same time. A Marianne Brandt teapot is gorgeous, right? And useful. It's called industrial design, and you oughtn't poo-poo it.
What I'd be doing is hard work, but my guess is that it'll pay off grandly. With a company, with a product, I have an infinite number of possibilities. They change car designs every year, which means a new opportunity to make my mark.
And another reason to avoid spending time together.
Don't be silly. We're together right now.
You're working all the time, either in class or in your studio. Now this car project.
You could work as well, on your poetry.
She expected him to rage out of the room, but instead, he sighed.
I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. I have no right to stop you from exploring whatever you want. I'm taking out my own writer's block on you. It's just that you're so prolific. Whatever you do turns to gold. As for me, I'm a champion at dinner parties. No different from my father.
She'd never admit it out loud, but his words contained a kernel of truth. Clara wasn't a struggling teacher anymore, was finally making her own way, but every so often she got the impression that Oliver didn't approve of her independence. His happiness at her early successes had soured with the more recent ones. He'd seen his mother's independence stifled by his father, and sometimes Clara worried he was falling into a familiar pattern. If only his work would sell.
How about you try a different form? A short story, perhaps.
Don't you worry about me. I've got all kinds of things up my sleeve. We'll hear good news soon. I'm sure of it.
She certainly hoped so. They kissed, and she wrapped herself tightly around Oliver, her head on his shoulder, before falling fast asleep. Clara could hardly wait to get home after her illustration class the next day, to see if Mr. Bianchi had left a message for her. If he accepted her offer, she'd get paid not only for the advertisements, but also for the interior design of the car. She'd be able to add industrial designer to her title, charge a princely sum, maybe even convince Mr. Lorat to let her teach the subject. Her head swam with the possibilities. As she burst through the doors of Grand Central onto 42nd Street, she spied a familiar figure leaning against one of the lampposts, inhaling a cigarette. She marched over.
How's Grand Central's most famous Armenian painter doing these days?
He lifted her off the ground in an enormous hug.
My dear Clara, there you are.
He set her down on the pavement with a thud, and she stumbled briefly before finding her footing.
Enough, Levon. Shake hands like a normal person, will you?
You're a vision. We must walk together.
She'd planned on taking a taxi, one of the perks of having a constant stream of income. Last year, she would have taken the subway to spare the expense. But now it was no longer a second thought. She considered asking Levon to join her in the cab, but it was a brilliant May day. A walk would do her good, and whatever Mr. Bianchi had to say could wait. Better to make him wait, probably. They turned onto Fifth Avenue. Usually, maneuvering along Fifth Avenue this time of day was a matter of dodging tourists and pedestrians coming the other way, not to mention human cannonballs careening out of doorways with no regard for the regular flow of foot traffic. But walking with Levon was much like being one of Moses's followers, she suspected. His mass, his posture, caused the river of humanity to flow around him. He moved in a straight line, which meant she did as well.
How is your illustration class going this term?
He asked. Some are brilliant, others less so. But I had a very productive meeting with the head of Studebaker Cars yesterday. She recapped the meeting, keeping her excitement in check in case Mr. Bianchi didn't follow through. He grinned down at her.
Fantastic, my girl. I hope you don't forget me when you're the toast of the town.
But something in him was off. Levon's strides were hurried, as if he wanted to get away from her. She regretted reveling in her enthusiasm, her success. A year ago, he'd been the hero of the school and had used his influence to help her. She shouldn't crow. Tell me, what are you working on these days?
I'm a whirling dervish in the studio. No one can stop me.
The usual bravado came out forced. I don't believe you. He made an exasperated sound, like a horse fluttering its lips. When he spoke, the words were so soft she had to strain to hear them over the din of the streets.
That photograph, the one of my mother and me. I can't seem to get the painting of it right. I finish one and then immediately start on another.
Can I come see? His face darkened.
No, I don't let anyone come to my studio anymore. I'm not ready.
She remembered how she'd been stymied until Oliver had lent a hand.
You're stuck. Maybe I can help.
You'll have me put a bottle of soda in my mother's hand. Is that your answer?
Don't be petty. You're a great artist. Are you sleeping? The dark circles under his eyes told her what she knew already.
Not really. I can't finish it. It will never be right. And I'll keep going on, and I'll never be able to afford bread and tea again.
They were both propelled by childhood memories of hardship, Levon's far more ghastly than her own, which was probably why she had been able to overcome the fear of failure while Levon was succumbing to it.
There's plenty of work out there. Times are good. Don't do this to yourself. Is Nadine a help?
She went off and got engaged to a stockbroker. I don't blame her. How's your lapdog?
For a second, she was unsure what he was talking about.
Stop. That's not kind. Oliver is a sweetheart.
They passed a bench, set back from the street in a shady spot. Do you mind if we sit for a moment? He sank onto the wooden bench like a puppet released from its strings. She angled toward him, one arm draped over the back of the bench.
Your work is strong, Levon. Why not let others see it? What if they think it's wonderful?
What if they don't?
It's worth the risk. Trust me.
You wouldn't know.
She did her best to maintain an even tone.
What do you mean by that?
What I do from my heart. What you do, well, it's business.
She remembered their debate that night in the village, in front of the students. There was no reason for him to have changed his mind. Not Levon.
Oh, for God's sake. I won't apologize for my success. I won't apologize for my ambition. Why fight me on this?
He tensed with a cat-like ferocity. For a moment, she thought he was going to leap into the middle of the street, end it all under the wheels of a passing car. Instead, his head dropped onto her shoulder.
I'm done for, Clara.
She bent her arm around him, averting her eyes from curious stares of passers-by.
What a sight they must make. A pietà of giants, all long limbs and wide shoulders, the man silently weeping.
Chapter 12. June 1929. As she'd hoped, Mr. Bianchi offered Clara the chance to reinterpret the interior of the Dictator, as well as take the lead on the advertising campaign. She immersed herself in the job, stopping by the factory twice more, staying up all night sketching out dashboard designs and advertisement ideas. Even though her schedule was packed, Clara made a point of stopping by Levon's studio every few days, dropping off some bread and cheese or soup, waiting until he'd eaten it all before heading back out. From what she could tell, he still hadn't made much progress on the paintings, but she made a point of not speaking about art, either his or her own. Today she'd brought an apple and some cold chicken drumsticks wrapped in brown paper. A lazy heat had settled over the city in the past couple of days, and she didn't want to have to turn on Levon's stove. Striped awnings kept her own apartment cool, but she knew his top-floor studio would be sweltering. She knocked twice before letting herself in with a spare key, which she'd pilfered after he'd refused to answer the door one day. She'd had to pound away until he finally let her in, looking morose and surly. This week had shown signs of improvement. He'd had other visitors one day, and on the others, she'd found him reading a book or newspaper instead of indulging in his melancholy. "Here, eat this before it spoils." She laid the bag on the table as she unpinned her hat. Levon wore a white undershirt and blue serge trousers. He reached for his shirt, which lay over a chair, sweeping it about him like a cape and tucking one arm through. "You don't have to do that for me. It's too hot for long sleeves."
"I'd never be so gauche as to eat in front of a lady with my arms bare. I may have been raised in a dirt hut, but even peasants have standards."
She laughed. "You're about as far from a peasant as any man I know. You're a secret member of the aristocracy, no? Russian, perhaps? I've always suspected that accent wasn't quite right."
"If only. My father was a cobbler, not a duke."
He sighed, hiding a smile. "What was he like?" She'd found that getting him to reminisce often lightened his mood, which was especially odd, as most of his memories were sad, bordering on grim.
"Simple but strict. He fled before the worst of the persecution began. I remember once, a few months after my father was gone, a Turk tried to steal from one of my neighbor's homes. In the darkness, he hit his eye on a nail, blinding himself, and was caught. The Turk went to court and insisted that my neighbor was responsible for his accident, and the judge agreed. They pinned him down and gouged out his eye as well."
When he ranted like this, it was best to stay neutral. "How biblical." Levon burst into peals of laughter.
"That is why I adore you, my Clara. You are not afraid of anything. You don't cower like the rest of them."
"What happened to your father? Did you ever find out?"
"He started a new family in the States. When my sister and I finally came here, she wanted to try to find him. But what was the point? He had left us behind in that morass. I wanted nothing to do with him."
"How did you manage when you first got here?" If she could remind him of his resiliency, maybe he would break free from these doldrums, return to the passionate man she'd first met.
"I found work in an art store. I've always drawn, even when I was young. I made paints from whatever I could find. Pear juice and peels, from egg yolks. You're the same way, no?"
"I suppose." He lurched over to the painting of his mother.
"What if I can never finish it?"
She stood behind him. Sections of the canvas shone like porcelain, from the application of multiple coats of paint, followed by scraping and sanding until only a reflective layer remained. While arduous, the technique worked. The finish showed depth that she'd seen before only in the work of Vermeer.
"Who says you have to finish it anyway? Why not keep on painting for as long as you like?"
"You're saying that so that I do the opposite, right? That I fight back and say that I must finish it."
He was impossible. "Do whatever you must, Levon.
It's too hot to argue with you today. Let's go out.
Where?
She opened her leather satchel and pulled out a sheaf of papers.
The Heckscher Building. Three society ladies are creating a museum of modern art there later this year, and I was asked to stop by and give my opinion on some works they're considering.
Which artists?
Cézanne, Gauguin, Seurat, and Van Gogh.
She handed over the list. He scanned it voraciously.
So many.
They're aiming for 100 artworks. Can you imagine? We can see them firsthand right here in New York, and they already have a dozen at the gallery.
It's an exciting prospect.
You should come. What exactly are you doing for them?
Mr. Lorette told them I'd take a look at the space, offer my thoughts on the light, that sort of thing.
Why didn't he ask me?
Good. The old competitive Levon was seeping through. She tried not to smile. Because you've been a miserable wretch the past month, and he was probably afraid to approach you. Like almost everyone else at the school.
But not you.
No, not me. In the gallery space, a woman in her 60s, with a frizz of caramel-colored hair poking out from under a hat, greeted Clara and Levon as they entered. I'm Miss Lily Bliss. You must be Miss Darden. I do love your covers. Such an air of whimsy to them.
Thank you. May I introduce you to Mr. Zakarian, also of the Grand Central School of Art, and a painter?
Pleasure. Miss Bliss turned back to Clara and began rattling on about frames, shipping fees, and storage. Clara already regretted bringing Levon, who sulked quietly behind her like a fretful bear. She wished Miss Bliss had at least recognized his name. A slight man with crooked teeth and a high forehead approached.
Ah, Felix, you've arrived.
Miss Bliss greeted him warmly. I certainly have, and am eager to offer my strong opinions and have you shoot them down.
The words came out in staccato stabs. Miss Darden, Mr. Zakarian, you must know Felix Hornsby. Of course. Oliver had pointed him out to Clara during a cocktail party as one of the city's most distinguished and successful art dealers. His unremarkable presence, more like that of a plumber who'd come to fix the sink, caught her off guard at this second sighting. Clara held out her hand.
Mr. Hornsby, we have a mutual acquaintance, Mrs. Alston Smith.
Oliver's mother had recently purchased several Steichen photographs from Mr. Hornsby for the Newport house. As expected, the man regarded her with a great deal more interest now. Connections. Always connections. Miss Bliss waved her gloved hand.
Such a small world, we art lovers. Everyone please follow me. I just received a special piece from France, and you'll be the first to see it.
In the next room, two assistants lifted a frame out of a wooden crate with care. They all leaned over to examine it. A Van Gogh.
This is Madame Ginou, said Miss Bliss. What do you think?
In the painting, an older woman in white, wearing a mint green scarf and matching cuffs, rested one elbow on a table. Her craggy closed fist supported her cheek, and she seemed both amused and sad. The strong eyebrows and coal-black eyes reminded Clara of Levon's mother's portrait. But this woman had not been abandoned. Her face showed resilience and a fading beauty. It was not a plea for rescue. Clara took in the clarity of the painting like a drunk to whiskey. This is the woman she wanted to be in 40 years. She wasn't a beauty, or at least hadn't been spruced up to be prettier than she was, the way the famous portraitists of the time tended to do. She was hardy, wary, and tender.
If you like this, you really should visit Levon's studio. Clara addressed Mr. Hornsby directly, avoiding Levon's open-mouthed stare, daring him to defy her boldness. His work is exquisite. Mr. Hornsby nodded.
I've heard many good things about you, Mr. Zakarian. I remember your work in the Grand Central Art Galleries last year.
He slapped Levon on the back. Levon didn't bellow or storm out as she feared he might. Instead, he remained strangely mute as they wandered through the rooms, while the rest advised Miss Bliss on lighting and paint color. After the tour, Levon made his excuses and left without waiting for her. Here she was, giving him the opportunity of a lifetime, and he'd blown it. What bothered her most was that his work was terrific. She hadn't embellished her admiration. Mr. Hornsby, I'd like to invite you to see Mr. Zakarian's studio. Mr. Hornsby looked confused. Wouldn't he normally invite me himself? He would, but he was in a rush to get back in paint. Why don't we meet there tomorrow at 1? She'd drag Levon with her into the blinding glare of success, in spite of his moods and lack of any social niceties. Just as Levon had unknowingly inspired her at the May ball, she would prop up Levon for as long as she could stand him, offer him access to her contacts and her sway. His works deserved to be seen and sold, she was sure of that, and perhaps one sale or even an encouraging word from someone like Felix Hornsby would lift him out of the darkness that pulled him back to the pain of his past. He'd be furious, but she didn't care. Clara let herself in with the key to Levon's studio and looked about. The weather hadn't cooperated one bit. Dark storm clouds brewed beyond the slanted windows, rendering the place more like a vault than an airy artist's loft. But she'd have to make do. Mr. Hornsby would be there any moment, and she wanted him out by the time Levon returned from teaching his class at 2. A lightning bolt cracked like a warning as she arranged the easels in a U-shape, before turning to the dozens of paintings leaning against the walls. She examined each canvas carefully before deciding either to place it on an easel or prop it on top of an empty shelf or mantel, as close to eye level as possible. Levon's breadth of talent astounded her. So many different ideas, wrangled and re-wrangled, resulted in a powerful array of images. Except his imitation Picasso's, which she tucked out of view in the small bedroom. Clara stepped back and surveyed her efforts. Not bad at all. But where was Mr. Hornsby? She waited, hopeful at first, but after 45 minutes, she began to panic. Her plan was to amaze him with the artwork, get him to agree to represent Levon, and then show him the door so she had time to write the room. She'd tell Levon the good news when he returned from teaching. But time was getting tight. A fierce bang on the studio door brought her to her feet. She sprang for the latch. Mr. Hornsby stood on the other side, rain dripping off his hat and down his shoulders.
I couldn't get in. I've been waiting downstairs for 5 minutes. I was about to leave when someone came down and let me in.
I'm sorry. She must not have heard the buzzer over the chainsaw of rain slamming on the roof. Please, I'll get you a towel. She ran to fetch one from Levon's tiny bathroom, where a delicate child's brush balanced on the edge of a pedestal sink, strands of black hair entwined in the bristles. The unexpected intimacy brought tears to her eyes. For all she knew, he'd brought it with him from his homeland, carried it all that way. The image of a young Levon running it through his thick mane in an effort to appear presentable in the midst of so much turmoil, pained her. The fact that Levon, as a grown man, used it still was unbearably sad. She pushed it from her mind and went back out, offering tea and cookies, anything to swing Mr. Hornsby's foul mood.
No, I don't have much time. Where's the artist?
Lavard is running late, but why don't we start here with the still lifes? Mr. Hornsby surveyed them. Various arrangements of pears and figs in bold, almost garish hues. They moved on to the drawings, including one of a woman in bed, the covers pulled up to her chin. Then landscapes, a couple of self-portraits. He didn't speak, didn't nod, offered no sign of his reaction whatsoever. Finally, they reached the painting of mother and child.
That one's of his mother when
Mr. Hornsby cut her off.
Don't tell me anything about it.
He moved closer, then back. She stayed quiet. Mr. Hornsby was right. There was no need for words. She could tell the figures on the canvas haunted him, just as they had her. The rain ended, and a powerful silence descended over the studio, broken by a faint scratching sound. For a second, she thought maybe a mouse had skittered across the floor. But no, it was Lavon's key in the lock. He entered with his back to them, closing a large umbrella and giving it a final shake in the hallway. He turned around, staring at Clara, then Mr. Hornsby, and back again at Clara. She wished she could fall into a hole, disappear. Mr. Hornsby held out his hand, practically skipping across the room.
Mr. Zakarian, what a pleasure!
Lavon didn't respond. Mr. Hornsby looked over at Clara.
Is something wrong?
She implored Lavon with her eyes, keeping her voice measured, pleasant.
Mr. Hornsby is here to see your work. I arranged for him to come by.
Mr. Hornsby's expression turned from confusion to suspicion.
Mr. Zakarian didn't know I'd be coming. Did he?
She shrugged, waiting them both out. It was too late now. Let the games begin. Lavon barged across the room, and to Mr. Hornsby's credit, he ignored him. The man clearly had experience with temperamental artists.
How did you achieve the luminescence in the background of this one?
Mr. Hornsby pointed to a still life. Lavon stopped in his tracks. She recognized the desperate look in his eyes. Wanting acclaim. Wanting success. If Mr. Hornsby played him carefully, this just might work. They began discussing viscosity and tints. Lavon's words began measured, precise, but soon they tumbled out, just like in his painting classes. The two men shared the same vocabulary, which helped break down Lavon's defenses. The still lifes vibrated with energy. The self-portraits murmured with pain and loss. She finally understood why Lavon was reluctant to put his work up for inspection. His art was a direct reflection of his very being, which meant an analysis by someone like Mr. Hornsby was in fact an examination of Lavon's soul. Clara's illustrations were a completely different animal, outside of herself, a separate product, a business, as Lavon had put it. They approached the mother and son portrait.
It's not finished.
Lavon's words grew clipped again, all goodwill fading away. Mr. Hornsby ran his index finger over his bottom lip, staring hard.
No. To finish it would destroy it. It's the rawness, the empty spaces, that make us grieve for this woman and this boy. It should never be completed.
That pinprick of approval, of understanding, shredded Levon's carefully constructed facade. He stormed away, grabbing a pitcher from the table and hurling it across the room.
I'm done with this. Get out! I didn't invite you here, and you should never have come.
Levon, he understands. Let him stay. Don't do this. Clara shook with disappointment and fury.
Out! Now!
She grabbed her bag and hat and retreated, Mr. Hornsby skittering behind her. To her surprise, Mr. Hornsby accepted her apologies out on the street, patting her hand.
Don't fret, Miss Darden. I've been kicked out of many an artist's studio in my time. At least I didn't get hit by a pallet covered in wet paint.
But she couldn't let it go. Clara stewed during her illustration class the next day, angry at the unwarranted drama of it all. She'd done Levon a favor, even if he didn't recognize it. She clapped her hands together. All right, class. The break is over. Please take your places. Thanks to a favor from a Vogue editor, the students had been treated to a true fashion model today. A sylph-like girl who'd appeared in the pages of the magazine in the latest editorial layout. The model puffed on her cigarette holder before resuming her position on a green chaise longue that the students had dragged to the front of the room.
2 more hours of class.
Knowing she'd go mad if she didn't do something with the extra energy coursing through her body, Clara sat down at a drawing table near the back of the room, where she could survey her students' efforts while keeping her own work private. The model wore a cerulean blue georgette crepe dress with a dropped waist and neckline, wide sleeves, and a matching ring of rosettes that encased her hips. A turban covered most of her black hair. Her features were tiny and pointed, allowing the clothes to take center stage. Clara took up a pencil and sketched an outline, filling in details, taking her typical approach, elongating the neck, sloping the shoulders, and de-emphasizing the head. The final rendering was all curves and froth. Out of habit, she signed her name on the bottom right corner, along with the year. She stepped back and tried to view it as if it were one of her students' efforts. Pedestrian, rote, an object to be looked at once in a magazine and then tossed in the trash, a calling card for a business proposition. Turning over the paper, she tried again, this time from a purely artistic standpoint. How would Levon see it? Instead of sketching with fluttering light lines, she pushed down hard, not caring if it didn't align with the editorial perspective. The model became an afterthought the longer she concentrated, her focus staying on the paper and the drawing. She wanted to paint like Levon, from the inside. The model was exquisite, which only made Clara's irritation grow. Why did she have to be pretty? What did it mean that this woman was considered a beauty? The woman in the Van Gogh painting wasn't pretty, and that was why the artist chose her. Because she had lived a life and it showed on her face, in her posture. A smooth face was a bore. Drawing a set of perfectly bowed lips was fun the first time, but what if this time she made the mouth garishly wide? What then? And what if the fingers were thick stubs instead of long tapers? The drawing was a mess, but a good one. She unscrewed some paint jars, chose a flat brush, and swept a light water wash across the background. No, the water diluted the brush strokes. Working dry, she mixed the blue for the dress and laid it down fast, knowing it was a race against time before it set. The deadline worked in her favor, preventing her from second-guessing her decisions. So this is what Levon felt as he worked. Once she banished the running commentary of an editor's critique from her mind, the model needs to be thinner. Enlarge the masthead. Her imagination was free to play. She took what she saw in front of her and attacked the paper with little forethought. The rush stayed with her until class came to a close. She thanked the model, checked in with her students, and made sure the room was cleaned up before tucking the painting on top of the storage cabinet. Oliver was waiting for her by the clock on the concourse floor. They were due to catch the